Blog Talk Radio.
That the earth rotates around the sun because somebody says so. Agency, you have it, and you express it, and fortunately, there, when you have that kind of a mindset, you will keep it in the back of your mind as you go about your daily business. And can you imagine, and you do imagine, and you do know what it felt like when you discovered this body of ideas that has been in practice for hundreds of years. Surprise? Was it doubt? Was it a flood of questions? Was it that you had arrived? Remember when you were reading about and you were studying the craft and it was studying you. You learned about advancement by merit. And I was absolutely thrilled. I didn't think I would ever, I thought that was just a wild notion of teenage angst. A world without politics. Politics are a necessary conversation, necessary for us to keep things organized. No, what I'm referring to here is that sense of personal judgment of ourselves, the ability to examine the merit of our ideas, of our being, of our decisions, of our behavior. Now, I suspect many of us were raised to be good boys, and we weren't taught what that meant. We discovered that ourselves because we knew the difference. We knew the difference between being trash, even trash knew the difference between being trash and being good. And when I was a boy and where I was, it was our upbringing was rough. The education was not by enlightened minds. It was by these dear people needing a paycheck to pay the mortgage. Not necessarily knowing very much about children, or certainly nothing about child psychology or the way children absorb information. And we didn't bother ourselves too much with those details. But we knew. We could tell the difference. And we knew because when we were without adults in the playground or the class, things were going on that the adults couldn't handle, even today. Adults shouldn't be made too aware, most adults are too aware of what goes on because they couldn't handle it. Kids do. They have to. They adapt. Lord of the Flies? No. None of that kind of stuff. No. We knew. And today when we talk about when you and I are speaking about the development and growth of masonry, we know we might not have the language, we might not, but we can find it, we can learn it, we can adapt to it. And the nice thing is that it's all based on merit. I wish I was in those environments where, if you've been fortunate in your life, you've been in those environments where there's an enlightened attitude, where there's a grace to an articulation, there's a sophistication, if you will. And in some lodges, a few but some, we find that those men come together, and it's wonderful. It's an interesting experience, especially if you haven't been. It's like, do you remember the first time you went to an art gallery? What do I do? Where do I go? If you're a bit self-conscious the way I was, and people are sitting there, you could sit and actually ponder one painting. You read that little card that talked to you about the artist and when it was made, and maybe whose collection made the donation to the gallery. But you visited a second time, didn't you? And the second time you went on your own. And the second time you went at your leisure from gallery to gallery. And something struck your fancy, something that an image, a color, a composition that you never could quite want to leave your consciousness. Something that even now, as you hear this kind of a narrative, it can easily be brought to mind. You can do it while we're talking. Whether it's a Renoir or Degas or who. Not to say everybody has that experience, do they? But some, based on merit alone, ask the question, what is this? What is the person? What's the point? What's the person trying to say to me? What are they telling me? Is this an expression of emotion, or is it a story? And what is the point of the story? And And then we discover this whole business of poetry, not the stuff that we should have learned when we were little. If you were very fortunate, you did. But I tend to believe that you also had some skin in that fight. You're all by yourself. That there was something about the work that, shy or bold as you were, in your privacy, you could study it and you could wonder. Marlowe or Shakespeare, you could wonder about it. And that sense, we may not have become tremendous fans or disciples of the arts, but that sense of wonder, that questioning, hard to leave behind. And based on merit, you begin awkwardly to piece together a career. And then we find that all of the technical aspects are a precondition to expose your imagination. Comes full circle. Masonry does that for us. Brings us to acknowledgments and challenges. And your progress isn't based on what he wants us to believe or they think is necessary for our schooling. Don, you and me. The end of the day, our progress is our progress. It's that that subjectivity we call agency, that freedom of thought. Beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. And where do you go with it, or the meaning? Well, for goodness sakes, how can I or anybody else determine the meaning of your life? Get on with it, man. What's important? What are your priorities? Oh, if you're not sure, we have some fallback plans for you. We have a bit of insurance. It's not such idle curiosity when you begin to apply some of these philosophies to yourself and wonder again if that defines who I am and what does that say about me. The pleasure principle, I'm not so sure that's what drives people. The Epicureans would suggest it, but I'm not so sure. I think there's something a little more going on because I don't know that pleasure principle is the catalyst that brings on a good life. But I have a feeling that when I read or study the definitions of happiness, that there's something about the conclusion of the Stoics. And if I'm coming back to this too often, I sincerely apologize. The Stoics, the pathway to would suggest to us that the pathway to happiness is through virtue. Being a good boy who became a good man. Maybe my dear old grandfather is speaking to this little version, a grandson, maybe 8 or 9 years old, who was on to something when he said that a good man doesn't need a policeman to tell him how to live. Yeah, the old Freemason was, I think, he was right. A man of reason doesn't need to be taught reason. He can be encouraged by how he sees these ideas applied by other people around, and of course the refinement what I might think as lightness or grace might well be an idea that I can modify when I begin to understand how that applies to you, how you think about those terms, and maybe not just think about them, how you apply them. We begin to approach this question about trust. Do we trust our own judgment? Do we hold back that little bit because, of course, nothing is as it seems? Well, it is exactly that. It seems that doubt and the fates are a part of the future, that there are forces and opposing forces. There's science that we understand and science that we don't yet understand. We have this explosion of ideas going on around us. It's wonderful. It's like being in this extended garden of flowers, of just where there's places that where you can sit either in the sun or in the breeze or in the shade and open your book and enjoy the vista and be lost in your thoughts. Be lost in your thoughts. Masonry. It does this. It has this tendency. And it has for a long time, but the beauty, the secret, it's your merit that has been the individual, the merit and the effort that has been claimed. It has been claimed. The merit of, we could say, it's the without the primary ingredient, you, masonry doesn't exist. Oh, yeah. It's your round. If you want to talk about that one, by the way, it's your round. But we should. For all these hundreds of years, we can be thrilled when somebody approaches us about formalizing our interests and being admitted, being judged. Remember, you didn't know what was going on in the backstory. Being judged. There's going to be a ballot taken about you. That's an unusual event in people's lives these days. Judgments, no, they proliferate. Usually they're self-serving and stuff like that. But you remember. And what next? Always the what next. Your merit, the merit that you've demonstrated in privately, is a validation of all of this. And the boys that can't and don't, well, it was very nice to know them. And I can respect them for auditioning. But I think they and us, whoever comes, even once, and leaves, we're better off for the experience. Because at least we know. At least we tried. So if you're fortunate, and you have that group of people around you that share the sense of enlightenment, and then you are fortunate. It doesn't have to just be in this, through the airwaves or your relationship with a book. Don't ever stop reading. How many of us went on journeys around the world when we couldn't get out of our neighborhood, but we could pick up Jules Verne and just soar to the stars? We don't own this, but we have this. And we can smile. When you see other people discovering themselves, it's worth a smile. Who's responsible? They are. We were sensible enough to take advantage of what's made available. These aren't common tools. There's some interesting tools. Some of them you have to study even to figure out what they do. Sort of like physics, isn't it? I want to build something. Well, do I need engineering? Do I need physics? What do I need? I need mathematics. Do I need a tool to measure that? Or do I use my human body? Do I use my forehead, my hand? We need some consistency, don't we? And my goodness, it might be useful to listen to people who have noticed some patterns and wonder what they're seeing. Are they sort of twisting it a little bit to suit themselves? Are they sort of shaping and bending it, their observations to suit their ideology? Or are they just being factual about it? That's what it is. I don't always understand it, but it is there. Well, which do we like? The conclusions that we can trust, but we can't always decide which one. And now we're in a time where in the Western world, narcissism is quite alive. It comes and goes. Yeah, it comes and goes through history, and it has before. But it is fascinating to see so many people who have felt that they don't have meaning, they don't have purpose, finding a way, even destructive, my goodness. I won't fault them for that. I won't fault them for finding a way to survive, to answer the questions in their mind about their identity. I won't fault them for that. That's vital and important. And I won't judge them according to my standards. That's what? Colonialism, imperialism, entitlement, yeah. That's elitism. No. They get through it the best way they can. And when they do that, we, men of some degree of merit, however modest, can show them an improved, better way. The honesty, that there is a pathway that is better. Why? Rightfully, they will ask, why is honesty the better path when I can get something by bending the rules? Well, somebody needs to be able to answer that, or are we just spinning it, making it up? Well, you're not alone asking that question or answering it. That's been done. And there's some really, really powerful, really quite powerful arguments and debates that will draw us along as if we're part of the discussion. We're looking over the shoulder of the philosophers and reasoning for ourselves, whether we come to the same conclusion is because we've reasoned through the experience of people around us, felt it was critically important. Make the decisions. Today, I won't entirely try to entertain, but I'll try to make this palatable. Not quite, but maybe we'll actually tip into being the entree. But for now, we have a little finger food and maybe what you like, a gin and tonic, a cappuccino, a nice cup of tea. You know that kind that you get in the nice Turkish shops, so thick and sweet. Oh. Anyway, we have a good program, and I think it will do you justice. See what you think. Amazing music, amazing gift. Yeah. Here, see what you think about this. The dance of a Freemason. Don't laugh just yet. Don't doubt for a moment. We teach ourselves to focus on unity, universality, and self-deprecation. We want affluence without decadence. We want to be in the company of men capable of ambitions and completions, and want his conscience to be clear. Justifications become reasoning. Motivation becomes logic. One man, one occasion, one influence at a time. The ritual is about us. It's about the man. It turns a boy into a man when he accepts what dominates and not what rests in the heart of a good man. Ours is the lot of the few who look beyond symptoms to sources. How can we fix the source and change the outcome further downstream? By putting men of conscience at the helm, that's how. Be successful, be accomplished, exhibit a poet's sensitivity with a philosopher's command. Living a stupid life may be easier to some, but a brother of the craft refutes that thinking by making his courage and tenacity appear simple. He lives with grace because he appreciates the difference. How many men come to us needing their thinking acknowledged? A knowledgeable mentor is key to advancing his well-being up to a point and assisting his search for meaning up to a point. Of course, there is turmoil with this unconventional thinking. Politics is the inescapable way we converse at a high level. It does assume logic or reason and is subject to the same enduring need to prove assumptions. We, you and I, are the balance. We strive best we can, able to explain our moral judgment. It may be labor that we perform, but we perform with lightness and grace. Respect is earned and re-earned until we are able to satisfy our own conscience, doing as thinking. Doesn't this make me a materialist? Oh my goodness. It's not meant to be hard or made hard. It is. It's complex. So the rash amongst us don't do well. Takes a bit of time, usually, for us to absorb what's going on and to understand the components, piece it together. Oh, I would have liked somebody to have told me that once upon a time. Yeah, but whether you have that kind of counsel available to you or not, you will find out yourself. Eyes wide open. Here, try this. try to bring you poetry that broadens your horizons a little bit. Today, it's the work of a Persian poet. He died about 800 years ago. He was a mystic in Islam, a Sufi. It's an Islamic belief and practice in which the Muslim will seek to find the truth of divine love and knowledge through direct personal experience of God. Here, why poetry? This is an interesting man, 13th century mystic and Islamic scholar, considered one of the greatest poetic geniuses and spiritual masters of all time. You judge for yourself. Of course, you need to do a bit of a comparative analysis to know whether he warrants this kind of accolade, but I tend to think it's worth a bit of attention here. It is said that he was an independent spirit with a unique personality. He was influential. Time and age didn't matter, race, background, social class didn't matter, religion didn't matter. But he seems to have a universal appeal and a message of courage. And what's interesting is a comment about him, his refusal to follow outdated dogmatic thinking, conform to norms and cultural taboos, or subscribe to the slave mentality. After 800 years since his death, he's still very popular. His work is still very popular. His teachings go on, and his writings continue to inspire millions. This is all over the world, so you're probably familiar in your own language. Yeah. If it inspires, if it's been inspirational for that long, his work, I thought maybe the audience, you, would like to know why. What's the big deal here? And I only have one small taste. It's like, do you like licorice? Well, just taste a little bit. And these. It said about this, you don't understand poetry, you feel it. Nikhil Sundar said that. You feel it as a goosebumps, as somebody let the void inside you open. You feel it as a warm breath on your cold hands, as soft hair on your face. You feel it as a smile, as tears, as loneliness. You feel it as anything non-materialistic. You feel it in your being. In your light, I learn how to love. In your beauty, how to make poems. You dance inside my chest, where no one sees you, but sometimes I do, and the sight becomes this art. There are two types of poetry Rumi shared with us, the fiery love poetry with its ecstatic embrace of the divine. These poems express the delight and awe he experienced when his understanding of life reached a high level. And when his new awareness allowed him to go through the door to a new vision of the world surrounding us, his insight into this hidden world is expressed in the beauty of his poetry. The other type of poetry is found in his work as an explanation of the journey which led him to the door of this new ability to see beyond the limits of external form. I can't tell you when he wrote it. This is a translation by Anna Marie Schimmel. Tell me your thoughts. But do it with this question in mind, please. What awareness do you know or understand right now? And will that change, or has that changed as a result of the ideas in this poetry? In other words, we'll go through your day thinking about, noticing the things that are about awareness, and not the habit of life, but awareness, emerging awareness. And so you sort out what that means. It's not me. I can't do that for you, possibly. Oh, you who've gone on pilgrimage, where are you? Where? Oh, where? Here is the beloved. Oh, come now, come. Oh, come. Your friend, he is your neighbor. He is next to your wall. You, erring in the desert, what air of love is this? If you'd see the beloved's form without any form, you are the house, the master. You are the Kaaba. You. Where is a bunch of roses if you would be this garden? Where one soul's pearly essence when you're the sea of God? That's true. And yet your troubles may turn to treasures rich. How sad that you yourself veil the treasure that is yours. Damn, don't you hate it when poets are really, really powerful? No. Thank you. of Ike Quebec. This is a part of history we're going to walk into, as we usually do at this point in the show. It's a point of history that I've been waiting for a long time, waiting to talk about and share with you. For me, this work it helps me answer what came across the pond. You know, masonry started over there and then came here. And I don't mean the cliches. I'm not talking about that. And it's always made me wonder whether, you know, it was the uniqueness and the idiosyncrasies of culture and history that produced this outbreak of thinking in Europe in about roughly the same time, not just in one area. That's why we can't say, well, he was the genius that made it happen. They were the people that were the spark, because we don't know that. But what we do know is that there's this phenomena that some ideas just seem to emerge in different parts of the planet at approximately the same time. How is that like there, you know, raises the question about the history of all humanity, that somehow we're linked. It raises the possibility. Of course, that's silly thinking. Of course. Radical impulses, she calls it. This is Birgit Jacobs' tidy little piece, Living the Enlightenment. Given Masonic rhetoric, it should come as no surprise that early in Masonic history, we can detect a politically radical underside, one which is particularly evident on the continent later in the century. That's us. But before turning to continental Freemasonry, its mores as well as its origins, we should ask if the reforming impulse we have found in British Freemasonry derived from sources other than the legacy of country ideology. There is some evidence, tantalizing, although by no means conclusive, that also links Masonic fraternizing with habits and behavior found in politically subversive groups, as well as with Whig Party, socializing both before and after the Revolution of 1689. This evidence needs rehearsing for the links it provides between the 17th century revolutionary tradition and Freemasonry, as well as it helps to explaining 18th century Masonic beliefs about the origins of the fraternity and its mythical relation to Cromwell and English revolutionary traditions in general. Social clubs were commonplace enough in late 17th century England. Within political society, however, we were to be found more among Whigs than among Tories. Whigs. Liberals. Today, the relative lack of private clubs among Tories has been offered as one explanation of their relatively less organized political base in the decades after 1689. By contrast, Whig fraternizing dated back to the 1680s, when the Whigs were the party of opposition, even of subversion. Not least, Whig clubs often display in their records a markedly anti-clerical or even libertine character. The notorious Calves Head Club donned priest vestments for their ritual pope burning. The Kit Kat Club of the 1690s reveled in the impious and irreverent. The club called its members knights and had a president who taught what faith the priests of all religions hold. As its manuscripts remain and tell us, we should not forget that Toland's Socratic Brotherhood was also convened in the pantheonisticon of its president, similarly a libertine group that met in The Hague, of which Toland had kept one of its handwritten minutes, called its members knights as well as brothers. In contrast, Tory clubs toasted church and monarch, or reserved the right to silence any brother who shall, in his liquor or any otherwise, talk anything that shall ridicule the Holy Scripture or religion. Yet both political parties assisted in the formation of civil society. In a new tone of social experience, such behavior, overtly political or simply convivial and leisured, as now was found among merchants and tradesmen, had little in common with the traditional and protective fraternizing of the guilds. Yet this new sociability, characterized by an affluence that made feasting and drinking into affordable pastimes, might easily be grafted onto the practices of a guild and might in turn transform it into a voluntary society of gentlemen. Not surprisingly, where we find the first somewhat circumstantial evidence for the existence of a purely speculative lodge in England, it appears to have been established among London gentlemen of decidedly Whiggish inclinations who had friendly relations with the city's company of Masons. 18th century British Freemasons said that the first speculative lodge was headed by Sir Robert Clayton, Lord Mayor of London, Scrivener, and an extreme Whig. What did you hear? What did you hear? What I heard was the context. The context of me. The backstop were these established social clubs. Again, like-minded people coming together for political purpose to either, you could look at it as, you know, socializing and just a convivial good time, or you might notice political undertones, business being done, sharing ideas. My goodness, it makes me think that over here we didn't have that. We didn't have that backstop. We didn't have that context at all. We were that context. We became the social club backstop. You see, when you have that, you have already have established social clubs and the conviviality and all the rest that goes with that. You don't need more of it. You need something that would be an exception to that kind of pleasurable outing. And to do that, you could see the thoughtfulness and the presence of mind, addressing serious questions would be completely in order, because there was no shortage. You could go out to dinner with your mates, have a nice and affordable meal, great company, drink, it's a good time. Over here, we didn't have that. We had to make that. What crosses what crosses my mind is how we evolved to the situation we're at now, where there's still that great number of people who want nothing heavy to go on around in the Sonic Lodge. It's all light. It's getting together, having a good time, eat, drink, do the ritual, and get through it as quickly as possible, because it's not eat, drink, be merry. It's work of a sort. And gradually, if you think about that, the pleasure principle would overcloud the gravity of purpose. And who wants to talk about philosophy when you're having a party? You want to get together. Well, nobody. If you don't have anything else, it becomes all-encompassing. Not to say that it's all good or bad. No, I don't live in that binary junction. So some areas would fare better than others. Some would moderate it. Others would expand. Depends on the chemistry at the time, doesn't it? The mindset of the membership. What do they need? What do working and tradesmen need at the time? What do the intelligentsia, the literati, need at the time? The same? I don't know. I would tend to suggest their needs are quite distinct. And so you would create it if you don't have it. Who knew? Who knew that when they came across, nobody could say, well, if we're going to establish this network of Masonic lodges, you need some of the context. You need a culture with some significant norms and mores. You need a history. You need a presence of clergy. You need these things. And, oh, by the way, you need this socialization, not in and of the fraternal order, but as a backstop for it. And where do we find that today? Well, I think a lot of that group were wondering where is that group? Well, they've gone on to develop that social backstop. When you think about it, where does a lot of business and politics get conducted at a high level? On the golf course. A little bit of sort of a bit of a test, a bit of competition, but as any serious golfer knows, it's a competition with yourself. Focus, concentration, skill, the joy when it works, that taking out the short wood, taking out, you can still, do you remember you can recall entire games in your head. You drive a green with a two wood. Ha ha. Just delightful. Answers. Answers, my gosh. Thank you. The end. Another occasion to be together is drawn to its natural conclusion. I hope you've been entertaining and informative. Thank you for tuning in, and we look forward to being with you again in just a few days. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness, and please, please, please be generous with yourself. Be generous in your heart, with your understanding. Be generous with your judgments, my goodness. Bye for now. Thank you.